It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bare on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Kirk O'Bare.
And I'm John Bernthal. How you doing, Kirk?
Doing pretty good. Hey, it's been a crazy week, you know?
Really? Did something happen?
A lot of stuff has happened. But, hey, I just want to start off by saying, you know, I know that people get their news from their preferred source. It might be MSNBC if you want to believe that we're all going to die. It might be Fox News if you want to believe everything's hunky-dory.
Or finally fixed.
Whatever the case may be. But I want to stick to the law. This show is about the law, and I want to discuss some of the legal issues that come up in the context of all this. And surprisingly, we get little sound bites here and there from news sources about what the law is, what it means, what legal implications there are for a lot of these decisions. But it tends to be more, this is perfectly within the president's right to do so, or it's not within the president's right to do so, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, understanding
that I get it.
Our country has suddenly become more divided by not only political affiliation, praise or criticism of the president and his actions, but also by news sources. And, you know, we've got all of them portend to give facts. Some admit that there are alternative facts that are part of that process.
Possibly one of the greatest quotes of all time to ever come out of the White House.
But people aren't going to listen to this show to rehear things that they've already heard from other sources. So with that in mind, I do want to talk about something that's been somewhat underreported in the media, but a very significant development with regard to elections and the future here in Wisconsin, and that has to do with the redistricting litigation that occurred and a recent court victory. And let's be clear here, this is not a victory for Democrats, it's a victory for citizens.
Absolutely.
And it was not an action that was brought by the Democratic Party, it was brought by individual citizens who had a very strong argument that there was disenfranchisement going on. But I want to give a little bit of history behind why we even had this issue come
Fire
up.
Fire away.
As you know, every 10 years there is a nationwide census. And that census data includes information that, you know, we all report. You've probably complied with the census request before, right?
I not only comply with the census request, but I also got hit up just like last year for sort of a midterm, I guess, for lack of a better term, census inquiry. So they do this with selected people, apparently, and they get all these threatening letters. You have to do this by law, you know. I did it voluntarily anyways. But the census data is critical for determining, well, not only congressional seats, but and districts, you know, in local politics, but also for federal funding for any number of programs and you know, that sort of stuff. So it's really important as to whether or not your state's going to, you know, come to the party or not.
Right. And, you know, the idea behind redistricting in its purest sense, why it's allowed, goes back to the idea that there are population shifts that occur, and it's not simply geographical, and it's really a way to try and equalize population changes. So, you know, depending upon whether we're going towards a more urban or a more suburban or a more rural shift, where the populations are increasing, where they're changing, that kind of thing, it's designed to provide some measure of equality so that the basic idea behind districting itself, which is supposed to equalize, you know, population centers. For example, in Milwaukee, there are a lot of districts. I think there's like 9 or something like that as it relates to the state assembly race. Let's just talk about my county, Sheboygan. It's divided into 2 different districts. It used to be roughly 1 with some minor modifications. Let me also inject here to say that this is not an exclusively Republican maneuver. It has been done by Democrats in the past.
In fact, it was done by Democrats almost exclusively for decades because they were in power in Wisconsin.
Right. Correct. And so, you know, there has been a history of manipulation of districting. And last time around, the Republicans had the ability to really water down the vote. And here's how it works. It's just so you, I know you know, but our listeners might not. The way that districts are divided, depending upon what particular electoral race you're talking about, because it's divided into, you know, we have cities, municipalities that are divided into different parts for their local races. Then we have counties that are divided based upon assembly races. We have state senate districts, which are larger, of course. Then we have U.S. congressional districts. We have U.S. Senate districts, et cetera. And the idea is that our state, if let's look at the presidential election and how that works. There are many different electoral districts that are established, again, based upon an effort to equalize population, et cetera. And when a state casts its electoral votes, they are deemed to be for whatever party has, at the end, achieved enough electoral votes for that state to cast all of them for a particular candidate. But looking at it on a more of a micro level, what happens in assembly districts, I'll just use that as an example because I just went through all this with my wife running for state assembly in the last election. And and basically what ended up happening was you have areas that are, and there's some guesswork involved here, but when the Republicans did this redistricting, what they did is they identified areas that they believed to be strongly Democrat. And what they did is they grouped them so that there would be waste, this concept of wasted votes. Because once a district has achieved its, let's just say it becomes Democrat based on a certain number of votes in that district, all those above and beyond that certain number don't count for anything because it's already been established there. So if you can pool together enough Democratic votes and concentrate them in certain districts, the end result is really a disenfranchisement of people that would be voting above and beyond what's required in that area.
Yeah.
And
what it, so,
go ahead.
Yeah, I just had a discussion with one of the guys that brought the redistricting lawsuit, and one of the there's two philosophies, if you will, in terms of redistricting, advantaging yourself during redistricting. It's called packing and cracking. I don't know if you've heard those terms. So packing is exactly what you just got done talking about. You pack everybody in a particular party into one district if you can, and you and again, like you noticed, there's wasted votes because there's this no way that anybody but the person from that party is going to win, and then you crack districts by drawing squiggly lines, you know, or like very strange looking district lines, so that you can advantage yourself with just enough votes to win, and you're just far enough above for, you know, in this case, Republicans, to always win that district. And the Dems will never be able to win that district. So it's not packed, but it's cracked for one party or the other. And that's really when the judges hearing this redistricting lawsuit made their decision. They looked at exactly that, and they found, not surprisingly, but that's exactly what they were up to. If you remember, back when this first was litigated, like in 2011, there was a different three-judge panel, looking at how the redistricting lines were currently being drawn, and there was this hugely secret process. Like, even members of the legislature didn't know what was going on. They didn't know. Nobody knew except for this very, very small group of people. And they were hiding things from the court, and they were admonished by Judge Stattmiller, a very Republican judge, for not being forthcoming in the whole process. And that begs the question, should these legislators be doing this job, or should we have a commission doing it?
Right.
I'd be interested in your opinion on that, Kirk.
Well, I think a commission should certainly be involved because, and it should be a transparent commission. It should be something that is subject to open records and reporting, and they have to publish their philosophy in terms of how this is done. Plus, we can make sure that the commission is nonpartisan or bipartisan that way. That's my view on it. What I don't want to have happen is that as a result of this decision, it goes right back to the Democrats where they do the same thing all over again. Then it's a perpetual cycle of tit for tat. You know what I mean?
And you know they're going to be tempted to do it.
And that's a really good point because it segues right into the next thing I want to talk about, which is the boycotting and the nuclear option issue.
That's exactly what I was thinking about. That's exactly right. Maybe after the break, we'll pick that up.
Sounds like a good idea. So let's take a break. We'll be right back after these messages.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. And we were just segueing from redistricting into the nuclear option.
Yeah.
And now, that's not actual nuclear weapons.
I know.
Just to be clear for the audience that we're not advocating or even contemplating use of nuclear weapons. Now, Donald Trump might be. Or the leader of North Korea, but that refers to the dismantling, if you will, of the voting structure for judicial nominations in the United States Senate. Specifically speaking, if you want to filibuster a particular candidate, like there's talk about filibustering Neil Gorsuch, the new nominee for the Supreme Court, then you would need, according to his current Senate rules, you'd need 60 votes for what's called cloture to end the filibuster. But, here's the funny part about the Senate, is that the party in the majority, they could just change the rules.
Right.
And that's the nuclear option. I don't know why they use such dramatic terms.
It refers to the fact that it completely decimates the other side. And there's no way you can – I mean, then that just removes the filibuster. That's it. It's gone. But we are going to circle back to redistricting, by the way. But this is a very good and closely related topic that deals with party politics. And – you know, one of the things that's been especially pronounced over the course of the past 2 weeks is the fact that we, I think, unfortunately, are dealing with a two-party system where only these two parties seem to have the grip on the political process. And, you know, I'd love to see
a viable
third party come out. Yeah. I'd love to see the Bernie people get their act together. Who knows? But I think Republicans also... I would not be surprised if there is a sub-Republican party that is in the works. I really have no idea, but it wouldn't surprise me, politically speaking. So let's talk
about a sub-Democratic party.
That could happen too, okay? Now, it's no surprise to you, always been a Democrat since the day I was born. In fact, I was sworn into the I got my card along with my baby footprints. And that's just because I feel very strongly about the Democratic Party, and it partly comes from my parents. It partly comes from where I grew up in New York and other things. But I will tell you this. I don't like party politics in the sense that it seems to bypass a lot of the important issues, and a lot of things are done strictly for the interest of whatever party the person tends to be a part of. So there's really two ways of looking at this whole issue with the nomination of the current Supreme Court justice. And everybody knows this from watching the news, but certainly the Obama administration was hobbled last year and into this year when a seat became open on the Supreme Court because of the passing of Antonin Scalia. And the issue then became, and I believe it was, approximately 9 months left in the Obama administration where
he died in February.
Right. So starting in March, naturally, you don't want to anticipate there being a, you know, close to a year-long period, 11-month period, where there is an empty seat on the Supreme Court. It's natural that the president would fulfill his duty to nominate somebody, and that was obviously Merrick Garland. That never that was completely shut down from day one, and it continued to be something where the Republicans simply refused to allow that nomination to go forward. It was the better part of a year of engaging in obstructionist behavior. Absolutely. There's no question about it.
This is just power politics. That's power all it is.
Right.
It's power politics, and pure and simple, and that's what Washington is made of. I mean, the rules of the Senate, and indeed of the House too, in fact, the existence of those deliberative bodies is designed to allow some sort of exercise of power even by a minority.
Right.
By a minority viewpoint. I mean, but of course, the party in power has most of the power. But now it looks like they're looking to exercise like literally all of it.
Right.
So to take away the filibuster, which has been, I don't know when it was first instituted, but I believe in the 1800s.
Right.
And it was designed to allow the slowing down of the process, because the whole idea of these deliberative bodies, and indeed the Constitution itself, is to slow down the process by which any particular idea gets instituted as part of law.
There are a lot of reasons for that.
So that by the time it goes through all these bodies and all these machinations, so that by the time it actually becomes a law, it's something from we the people, or at least that's the theory.
Right. And the theory, again, part of that theory is that every single person involved in the advise and consent process is somebody who is a representative in one form or another, either a congressman or, particularly in the case of a Supreme Court justice, the power lies in the Senate. And senators, of course, are also spokespersons on behalf of their states. And the reason that things should be slowed down is to have the opportunity for let's just look at this example. The nominee is announced. The members of Congress and the Senate then have the opportunity to figure out who this is, investigate the background, formulate questions, take a response to it. But that also is something that is supposed to flow from the constituents. So I, as a constituent, should, once I know who this is, should be able to communicate with my senator and tell that person if I have input on it, and participate in government for all the people,
yes,
like we say.
Yes, I like this person. No, I don't like this person.
And here's why. And to get input from legal scholars, to get input from the citizens, and rather than just ramming it through, which would be a pure party politics, that if it's okay, president's a Republican, I'm a Republican, I'm just going to ram this through because he wants me to ram it through. That's a problem. But let me just say this. The general concept that because the Republicans played dirty party politics, if you want to call it that, in the past year, does that mean that the Democrats should do the same? And this is actually a very confusing issue. My gut instinct says two wrongs don't make a right. My gut instinct says there is a way that you can pick your battles. And there is a very compelling argument here that although I don't tend to agree with many things that Republicans say, but I believe it was Mitch McConnell commented that, hey, let's face it, this is a Republican administration. You're not going to like anybody that is being nominated here. And in fact, our current nominee is probably going to do you better than anybody else who's lined up in the queue.
Well, you know what? Elections have consequences, as President Obama and many others have said. And I hearken back, really, to the 1980s when I was coming of age politically. And you grew up, you had your baby footprints on your Democratic card. I cast my first vote for Ronald Reagan. In fact, my first two presidential votes for Ronald Reagan. And I was very much a card-carrying Republican. And back then, it was possible to, I mean, if you remember, Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, two of the most, polar opposite politically people that you could imagine, right?
Right.
And yet they were as civil and congenial and as you could be. And because at the end of the day, It had a sense of common purpose, at least, despite the disagreements. So, in other words, you know, there was some American underlying unification there between even those two polar opposites. And we seem to be slipping away from that.
Slipping away from that for a while. It's been
for this century, actually.
Yeah. Well,
this century. So what it feels to me like, honestly, and I don't mean to be too much alarmist here, but this almost feels a little bit like the pre-Civil War era, where, not that I experienced that myself, but in the sense that it's us against them. And
right.
they are so bad. You know what? Back then, they just said we're going to secede from the Union. Well, you know what? California's been trying to secede from the Union for a long time. And but it's still this us versus them. But now it's not so much this state or that state. It's more like rural versus urban.
Well, or somebody commented,
rich versus poor.
It's the West Coast and East Coast versus everything else in the middle of the country. What one might say, you know.
Well, I kind of understand that. I honestly I don't know if I sympathize with it, but I understand that view because the coasts really do, you know, economically, they're the powerhouses, right? California,
true.
New York, Washington,
and
Miami, you know.
And another point in common with the pre-Civil War era is that the aligning of – then it was North versus South, but it's really the same economic and urban versus non-urban issues that are lined up right now. I mean, we have – we have the large cities on the West Coast, the large cities on the East Coast. We have, you know, a little blip here and there, Chicago, Milwaukee, you know. But otherwise, it's the great rural in-between that tends to be, you know, basically party affiliation has become the dividing factor and the defining factor amongst our citizens. And now more than ever, it is, are you with us or against us? We got to take a break, though, so we will be right back after these messages.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. Hey, just before the commercials came up, we're talking about the balance of power and how things have worked out, I think, really to the disadvantage of our country. And the, really, by having a strictly two-party system, we end up with it turns into a quasi-moral fight. But I don't know if it's really based on morals or ethics. It's, you know, it's the doubt. It's the mistrust of the other side.
You know, the interesting part as a side note here is that the Constitution says absolutely zero about political parties. Like, what do they have? The Whigs and the Tories in the 1800s. Wasn't that what they were? I believe so.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways,
yes.
Then
many parties that were actually part of our political structure. It was a lot easier to have a new party that actually the Know Nothing Party,
right.
Actually was based on racism. But you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah. So the
Bull Moose
evolution,
party.
The evolution. Yeah, the Bull Moose. Sorry, the evolution of political parties themselves, though, are really just. Sort of the same thing that we're going through today. In other words, there's economic powers that were behind the creation of the parties so that they can gain political power, I guess, to further their own economic interests. I mean, we saw this really during the post-Civil War era, too, and the Industrial Revolution and the rise of, you know, like huge class differences. And that's where a lot of these socialist sort of movements came to be. You know, I mean, we saw it in the city of Milwaukee. The Milwaukee had socialist mayors, and we had fighting Bob La Follette,
yes.
and we had the creation of the progressive movement, and those all evolved. You know, we think we live in turbulent times now, but think about living back then. I mean, and so
right.
That in a sense that gives me a little less fear about the future, because we've survived all that. But at the same time, you know, it's kind of disheartening to see the state of affairs, the state of uncivilness and division that has evolved here. That's what's discouraging to me.
And there's part of me that understands that You know, if you are not a student of history, you are doomed to repeat it. Who said that? Wasn't that Karl Marx or something?
I don't know.
No, it was,
I don't think it was Karl Marx. I don't know who that was, yeah.
Yeah. I'll look it up. I'll let you know. But it's a very common saying, and it applies, you know, to situations like this. But everything we've been talking about in terms of foreseeing the division of this country and its potential consequences, and all of the power funneling in a more sharp method towards one individual is precisely what we have always tried to fight against, because so that we don't have a monarchy or a dictatorship. But let me just talk about this nuclear option issue and three significant things that happened this week that call into question legally where we go from here. And I'll start with the first major event that happened this week that kind of shook everybody, and that was the firing of our attorney general. And this brought back memories of things that happened in the Nixon era, particularly because
Saturday Night Massacre.
Ironically, the Saturday Night Massacre, and now we're talking about the Monday or Tuesday Night Massacre. It was Monday Night Massacre. And the idea that the executive is supposed to involved in the process of determining who the attorney general is, but that is not an employee of the president. And if I hear somebody say that one more time, which demonstrates a misunderstanding of what the law is, the attorney general is not an employee of the president. The president is not the attorney general's boss, okay? That's what you hear from a lot of people. Hey, if you didn't do what your boss wanted you to, of course you get fired. Not true. And actually, when, ironically, Jeff Sessions was quizzing our deputy attorney general that became the attorney general with upon the request of none other than Donald Trump, the question was posed, what do you do when you disagree with or you know that, in your opinion, your legal opinion, having risen to be the top cop in the country, and when you believe that something is an unlawful order or something is unconstitutional, do you have the ability to say no? And she said, of course you do. I believe that the oath to defend the Constitution and the laws of the United States are very important. And in order to maintain the independence of the Office of Attorney General, there is a legal obligation to have an opinion about how that works.
Well, that's sort of the whole purpose of having, you know, the position
of having
the Justice Department
general.
Itself is to
right. Otherwise, the president could just implement and execute the laws on his own or her own. You know, and if it comes down to, and this is why we have to remember the old principle that you don't allow the wolves to watch the hen house, which is why we just saw examples of this recently when Manitowoc County is being accused of doing things that are incorrect, illegal, unethical, etc. You bring in an independent investigative agency to look at it. So if the president or anybody in the president's administration were under investigation for potential criminal acts, who is responsible for that? Mm-hmm. The Department of Justice, okay? So you can't pack the Department of Justice with yes men and yes women. That is absolutely not the way things work. So the fact that, I mean, there's no prohibition on the president, you know, quote unquote, firing the attorney general. That's exactly what was ultimately achieved when Nixon wanted to get rid of his attorney general. He tried to get other people to do it who refused. But the point is that that method is something that we have a history in our country of not tolerating that particular procedure, especially when the executive is attempting to overpower the opinion of the attorney general's office. The second thing that's significant here is our president's advice to Mr. McConnell to, quote unquote, go nuclear. Now, technically what he said is it's up to Mitch, but I told him if he has the chance to go nuclear, go for it. Kind of a mixed message there. He's not directing him, but he's telling him if you want to be happy, if you want to be part of the bandwagon, if you want to be, you know, singing the right tune.
Well, let me tell you the difference between those two individuals and their styles. Mitch McConnell is the ultimate Machiavellian. He is sly and slick and slippery, and he can play power politics with the best of them. But he does not lightly throw away the nuclear option, if you will. I don't believe he would do that, and here's why: is because he's been around for 30 plus years, and he knows that what goes around comes around, and he also knows that they're not always going to be on. I don't think Trump cares about whether he's on top of the heap 4 years from now. I don't think he cares at all. I think he wants to throw as many bricks as possible, as fast as possible, and hit as many people as possible. But that's not Mitch McConnell's long game. I don't think. And I seriously doubt he's going to do that. I think he has more respect for the institution and its rules and its history and its traditions than Trump does.
Right, and he knows that history because he's been part of that, and he really is the institution when it comes to that particular point. And he's come out and said he really hopes he doesn't have to do that. It's very un-American to take an end-run loophole approach to this type of thing just to make sure that the power goes the way it's supposed to go by the party that's in power. And it really does send a very bad message. But the third thing I want to talk about, and this has been reported. I want to caution everybody that it hasn't been fully developed yet, but there was a report, at least an allegation, unconfirmed at this point, but I want to talk about the possibility that this occurred. We're all aware of the fact that the president issued the quote-unquote immigration ban, Muslim ban order. You can call it what you want. He called it that. Sean Spicer tried to say, well, that's just because the media has been calling it that.
Because
the media
he called it that.
Because those are the words the president used not only in his campaign, but actually when he's announcing what the order is all about. And let's not forget Mayor Giuliani, who's been
expressly that that's where it developed. It developed from his proposal to ban Muslims.
All right. So the point is this. The executive order is signed. There was very quickly a lawsuit filed on behalf of two detainees or two people that had standing in relation to that particular order, that there was an injunction of sorts granted. And word is, I don't know if this has been confirmed yet, but there was an initial report of somebody who seems to know this, that President Trump directed those who have the power within ICE to ignore and disregard the federal court order. If that is true, we have a tremendous problem here because that, you could say that the encouragement of the nuclear option, okay, legal, illegal, probably legal, not great, not with our tradition as a democracy. The firing of the AG, okay, probably not a good idea. Is it absolutely against the law? Well, it's not clear. But advising somebody within the administration to ignore and disregard a federal court order is a profound issue. And we do have to take a break now, but we'll come back to that issue right when we come back. Stay tuned.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. So, Kirk, nuclear option, firing Yates, and ignoring federal judicial orders.
Yeah, one thing
are going great.
Yeah, well, regardless of whether they are or aren't, and again, tune into your regular radio source to form your own opinion on that. One thing I do want to say is that I had my doubts about whether President Trump actually would do anything that he promised to do. And, he is actually fulfilling promises, right or wrong, good decision, bad decision. I mean, he does appear to be a man of action. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? We'll have to see. There is a bit of a problem that I think is coming out bit by bit, and I think we talked about this a little bit before. When you look at somebody like Mitch McConnell, who, very savvy, as you said, Machiavellian kind of guy, but someone who is familiar with how things work and how to get them done in the context of the political environment. And yes, Donald Trump ran on the platform that there is a swamp in Washington, D.C., and he wants to clean up the swamp, etc. I don't know if some of the decisions he's been making have been reinvigorating that swamp mentality or not, but something like go nuclear, that kind of gets you right back into the party politics that he was hoping to clean up.
Well, you know what? Do you know what? Everybody comes in, not everybody, but many presidents come in talking about and campaigning on, I'm going to change Washington, and this is we're on a wrong course. And Jimmy Carter came in the post Watergate horror era in the awful 70s with his Southern team come into Washington, and they want to shake things up, and they were very quickly disabused of the idea that they were going to change much of anything, because Washington has an inertia all its own. Reagan came in with sort of the same attitude, except right. he sort of worked with he was riding the horse in the direction it was going already, you know. And then Obama comes in. He's going to change things, and it's hope and change and all that. And yet he runs into the same economic and political buzzsaws of power that are just omnipresent there.
Well, right. Anybody who runs can say what they want to do, what their ideals are, what they would hope to achieve. But when it comes time to actually dealing with the political process, which – you know, you can never anticipate what's going to happen, but you can anticipate that if it's a Republican versus Democrat or whatever type situation, you're going to get opposition between trying to do things. But I just wanted to pick up on what you said about Ronald Reagan, which I agree with very much, the fact that he found a way to not only have an agenda, but also get legislation passed. And frankly, let's look to President Obama, at least during his first term, with a lot of the successes that he had in terms of getting Congress to understand, you know, what the agenda was and why things were being done, and to get people to vote on things rather than just whoever the president's party happens to be. But if you look back to when Abraham Lincoln was elected and leading up to the election, he did something that created a tradition and that was not followed at all during this election, but that is the concept of bringing your enemies closer to you. And when that election, when the election occurs, and yes, he was very popular in one sense, but very unpopular in another sense, depending upon where you lived in the country. And certainly his election had a lot to do with the beginning of the Civil War. We know that. But what he did is that the people that were running against him and that were his most vocal critics were invited to become part of his cabinet. And the really brilliant thing about that is one of the historically most significant and effective maneuvers in politics that's ever occurred, is that that way you bring in people that are that have an interest and have represented people from a different point of view to advise you and work with you as the president in order to represent a different point of view, rather than having it be people that you know will follow your agenda.
There's a very famous quote from Abraham Lincoln regarding a cabinet meeting he was having, and he said something, and I'm not quoting this exactly, but he said something to the effect of, "All right, the votes are in. That's nine against." The yeas and the nays. So they said, "There's nine nays and one yay, the one aye rather." And he says, "The ayes have it." Of course, you know, right. and really, in a sense, you touched on this before. I agree with it. Is that Trump is actually doing what he actually said he was going to do, which could horrify some people or delight others. You know. And he's really something that we've never experienced before in terms of working with a deliberative body or working within a constitutional structure. His constitutional structure is him and his family and his son-in-law and his daughter making business decisions and then immediately implementing them.
I just want to touch briefly on another issue that I'm sure is going to continue to develop, and that is the seven Muslim countries, predominantly Muslim countries, that are on the list of countries not to trust. It's been said by Sean Spicer that this was actually based upon research that was done by the Obama administration. Kind of true, kind of not true. There were problems with those particular countries being able to vet people, and it had to do with the mechanics and systems in place there in those countries. Now, there was a recommendation that did include those countries to have not a ban on travel, but to not trust the internal vetting process of those countries and to enhance vetting for those countries, which, by the way, President Obama vetoed or did not follow that advice. So to say that this was a decision that was made by Obama or the Obama administration is a bit misleading. But I do want to point out perhaps the obvious, but people need to hear this if they haven't already. I believe it was 11 of the 19 9/11 murderers, terrorists.
Yeah,
came from
Saudi Arabia.
Came from Saudi Arabia. If you're looking at where terrorists come from, we have to look at India, Pakistan, Afghanistan. We have to look at, have to look at Jordan as well, one of our strongest allies.
Saudi Arabia,
United Arab Emirates,
Egypt, Lebanon.
And of course, Egypt and Lebanon as well. This is almost, it's almost nonsensical that you'd pick a few countries to enhance and to cut off the Syrian refugee program. That seems to be a completely different issue,
a completely different issue, and they're conflating it into being a relevant one, and then making these people who are victims of their own government's terrorism.
Right, they're escaping terrorism. These are people that are victims of the very thing that we're.
They're
so why
caught
are
between
these people
ISIS
suspect? You know,
and Assad. I mean, talk about like in a lose-lose situation. Let's see, I can join ISIS or Assad. Yeah, I think I'd rather go to Indiana.
Well, let's get back. We started off the show talking about this whole redistricting problem and the issues that it highlights. And I want to circle back.
Circling
to that
back.
Because one of the proposals on how to deal with this to stop the never-ending cycle of tit for tat, you did it, we're going to do it, we're going to have retribution for the unfairness of the past, it just leads to more of the same. And it emboldens the other party to do things that would be viewed as obstructionist. And, of course, we're seeing this play itself out in Congress now, and especially in the Senate with a lot of these committees that are being boycotted. And, I understand that that is a legitimate maneuver, but it doesn't go over very well. You know, there's a philosophy that voters don't remember obstructionists that's been said. But I wouldn't be so sure in this particular situation because the way that the media treats the situation, we've learned that facts don't matter as much as your political persuasion. And I'm sure that a lot of people that listen to the right-leaning radio stations and TV stations will have plenty of ammunition to use it as a basis to punish those Democrats next time around. And really, if we're going to look at where we go from here,
it's a possibility.
Much like the redistricting issue, I think what needs to happen here is to find a way to have it be nonpartisan or bipartisan and have an independent agency of some sort that is packed with
equals. That was proposed to these federal judges, which they soundly rejected.
Right.
And the reason they rejected it was because that was almost deemed to be unconstitutional in the sense that that the elected representatives themselves are supposed to be reflective of the people's wishes,
right.
And so therefore,
well, it touches on our state's heritage of having even elected judges. It's the same type of issue. That's why we don't really tolerate the idea of there being a judicial selection commission. We let them run for office. But anyway, we are out of time, and we'll obviously continue the discussion on these and many other issues that are affecting us on a daily basis.
That might present themselves in the coming week.
Yeah, true. I'm sure they will. So we'll see you next Saturday right here on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL. This has been Legal Defense with Kirk and John. Have a great weekend.
Have a great weekend.